We're going to have an informational meeting today. We're going to review the update on Oregon's prescription drug program. Passed the bill that implemented that in the 2003 session. There was an initiative in the last in the November election that expanded it. There are proposals to expand it further, and we thought it would be useful for the committee to find out where we are. You going to have the first panel? Janine and Missy, are you coming up together? A little support, that's good. It's a meeting going on.
We're in order.
Chair Greenlich and members of the committee, I'm Dr. Janine Smith. I'm the acting administrator of the Office of Health Policy and Research, and I just wanted to mention that is where the Oregon Prescription Drug Plan lives, is within our office, which is within the Department of Administrative Services. And Missy's been working there since April of 2004, kind of single-handedly, and more recently with even a smaller skeleton crew to do some amazing things. And I think it'll be interesting for you all to hear what all has happened.
Thanks, Janine. Chair Greenlich and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Missy Dolan. I'm the administrator of the Oregon Prescription Drug Program, and thank you for inviting me here today. Just as a brief background, the Oregon Prescription Drug Program was established by the 72nd Legislative Assembly. It was known as Senate Bill 875, the Bulk Purchasing Pool Program, and thanks to Chair Greenlich and Senator Morissette, that bill passed and was implemented began being implemented in 2004 and was launched in 2005. It basically is for two sets of groups of people. On one side, it's for uninsured people, and Senate Bill 875 authorized certain eligibility criteria, including age, income, and other criteria. It was actually pretty limiting, although it did encompass, we estimate, about 150,000 eligible Oregonians out of the approximately 608,000 Oregonians who were uninsured at the time. The other side of the program that was authorized to come into the pool were public sector groups. So that includes just about all government groups. Again, it was launched March 1st, 2005. The environment that was happening in 2005 for the uninsured, we were looking at Part D being implemented January of 2006. So if you all remember, during 2005, there were a multitude of Medicare, they call them Medicare discount programs, and it was pretty confusing in the market for the individuals. And when we launched in 2005 and we would go to health fairs and talk to uninsured and we would start reading the eligibility criteria, sometimes their eyes glazed over and say another, you know, complicated program. And it was really hard to have hundreds of people come through your booth and to sign up 10 or 15, but when you sifted through the eligibility, that's what we ended up with. On the group side, we were met with renewal cycles. We would go out and talk to the group administrators at the cities and counties, and they'd say, well, come back in 2 years when our contract with our current administrator is up for renewal, and we'll talk to you at that point. But on the other side, we had labor leaders calling us from all over the state saying, will you come down to Grants Pass? Will you come to Medford? Come out to Bandon? Talk to our administrators. We want to sign up. SEIU wants to support you. We were being called by all the labor leaders, and that was wonderful. We got in to talk to a lot of administrators. So that's kind of the environment. Just as a barometer of where we are, November at November last year, we had 4,000 uninsured individuals enrolled in the program. On December 7th, we had to implement ballot measure 44, which passed with 79% of the electorate thanks to the hard work of AARP and all the advocate groups and Senator Morissette, again, working all over the state to get support for that measure. And what that measure did was open the uninsured population up to all uninsured, all people without RX coverage. So we no longer had to go through that eligibility criteria sifting down. And we had to implement that on December 7th. By the end of December, we had 5,000 people enrolled in the program. We are getting hundreds of applications every day. We're getting inundated with phone calls, and I estimate that by the end of January, we will have exceeded 10,000 uninsured in the program. Now, if you flip over to the second page, even though we only had 4,000 people enrolled for the majority of the 22 months since inception of the program, we were able to save $800,000 for that uninsured population. That represents $28 per prescription. We have a generic usage rate of approximately 81%. The greatest discounts that we receive are on generic drugs because pharmacies have a greater margin, so they can give a better discount. The average discount that we're seeing in that program, in the uninsured program, is about 54.3% off of average wholesale price. On the group side, the highest membership we had was 4,000 members, and at December 31st, we were down to 500 members. We actually lost two of our largest groups, one of them because they wanted to become fully insured, both on their RX side and on their medical side. The other group moved out because the TPA, or the third-party administrator that was running the business, used another pharmacy administrator for 80% of its business, and they wanted to move all of it into one. And the other ones were not eligible to come into our program. That should say, I apologize for the acronym in the next line there, that the former pharmacy administrator account executive left during the year and was not replaced, and that really slowed down our progress. But finally, most importantly, I feel, is that took a new direction. We had new strategic opportunities that delayed group solicitation efforts during 2006. And if you look at the next slide, you'll see what that is. In January of 2006, we decided that we were going to need to change benefit administrators from the one we were using since inception. And their contract is due to expire the 31st of this month. So I notified them in January of 2006 that we would probably be going out to bid because we needed more servicing and improved servicing, specifically for the uninsured, but also on the group side. By July of 2000, I also started in January of 2006 to consider an interstate agreement with Washington. Washington legislature had passed similar legislation to Senate Bill 875, and their statute, like our statute, authorized them to look at interstate pooling. And so I started talking with them in January. By July, we actually had formed an interstate agreement with Washington, and the governor announced the formation of the Northwest Prescription Drug Consortium. And so we joined forces and immediately launched into a solicitation for a new pharmacy benefit administrator. And they helped with the negotiation. They actually added great value to that. They sent three highly qualified and professional negotiators and pharmacy experts down, and we spent about a month together negotiating a great contract with the ODS companies. And we're extremely satisfied with the new contract. It's going to bring much greater value than the former contract. The difference between the Oregon and Washington pools is that our eligible population at this point, after Measure 44 passed, is probably 1 million to 1.5 million. Washington's is estimated about 4.5 million eligible members. So you can see that they brought a lot of negotiating leverage to the table. The contract with ODS companies is one of the things that that both states shared is a vision, a combined, it's the same vision that we think that the intent of our statute is to bring the value that insured groups get to uninsured individuals. Right now, the uninsured are paying the most out of pocket. If they use our discount card, they get the same discount that you and I receive as insured individuals. And Washington felt that that was their intent as well. So our whole program is built around that concept, and that includes servicing. So when we talked to the ODS companies, we said we need customer service for our uninsured members, not just our group members. We need you to help with the enrollment process. We need you to take the phone calls, etc. They agreed to all of that. They agreed to 100% transparency. Transparency is really interesting. Everybody wants to see transparency. But unless you've got auditable reports, you don't have transparency. You have a promise for transparency and a pat on the back and a handshake, but if you've got real detailed reports, and ODS gave us real detailed reports down to the NDC number that tie to our actual utilization. So we have real transparency in this contract. They gave us service guarantees, and the service guarantees are tied to financial penalties that are very credible. They're very big. And these kinds of negotiations, and I should say negotiation wins, would not have been possible without Washington at the table. And so it was very beneficial to have my partners in Washington. We did demonstrate credible economic value by running a very large group from Washington, prescription drug experience, for 6 months through all of the numbers that ODS was presenting us with, and that included guaranteed rebates, it included ingredient cost, dispensing fees, and administrative cost, any cost associated with the program were put in through this equation. We demonstrated with a group of 165,000 members for 6 months experience savings, financial savings. That same program is what we're going to be putting into place February 1st. So we're in the process of a business implementation right now of the new contract. So, as I said, why an interstate consortium? The shared vision, of course. The shared expertise. On our negotiating team were people like Barney Spate, Donna Sullivan, a pharmacist with a PhD who actually runs their PEB prescription drug program, who had experience working at Mercer, writing RFPs or response for proposals for Mercer.
Translating.
So we had the negotiating strength of 5.5 to 6 million lives. I think it's important to point out that a lot of people will tell you, well, you know, we have an insurance plan with X number of lives in it. How can this program be successful because they only have 8,000 or 10,000 people in it? And I'll tell them, and I will tell you, that at the table we demonstrated a financial package that outdid one of the largest pharmacy benefit managers in the country, and they have some 40 to 50 million members. So I think that your potential growth is very important, and that's 5.5 to 6 million members was a big negotiating strength. Another thing I want to mention the Pharmacy and Therapeutics Committee. Right now, both states have a Pharmacy and Therapeutics Committee and all the processes associated with them, and they all use the Evidence-Based Practice Center up at Oregon Health and Science University. So that's one of the things we'll be looking at in the future. Are any of those processes ones that we can share so we're not duplicating efforts? While we've been going through this process, we're getting calls from Idaho. We're getting calls from Montana. Why haven't we been invited to the table? And how did you get there? How do we start? I'll be going to Idaho in April, actually, to talk to them about the program. We even got a call a couple weeks ago from New York, and last week I got a call from Arkansas. So everybody is watching this effort. Everybody wants to talk about how we got here, where we're going from here. It's pretty exciting. I think that, you know, what we've done is we've increased access to prescription drugs for the uninsured. We've provided tools to encourage smarter purchasing. We've reduced cost trends for the public sector groups that have joined. And we use medical guidelines based on scientific evidence to develop our preferred drug list. Excuse me. Where do we go from here? In February, we will be launching with our partners like AARP and Oregonians for Health Security and all of the advocates that have been supporting this program, a big bang marketing outreach all over the state to reach the uninsured, to let them know that if you don't have prescription drug coverage, you are welcome into this program now. The word is spreading like fire. Like I said, hundreds of applications a day. We're carting boxes of them to ODS weekly for ODS to be loaded, and they're all loaded into the ODS system to go live and deliver new ODS ID cards by February 1. The other thing I'd like to just mention is that because we've got a new contract, we did submit an addendum to our pharmacy contract. The pharmacies in Oregon have been very supportive of this program. We've had a very credible network throughout every county since the inception. The addendum is asking for deeper discounts, and we are receiving a very positive response. Right now, we've received signed addendums from pharmacies in, I believe, almost every. Maybe there's one county that hasn't come in, but I'm not sure if there is a pharmacy in every county. But they're coming in every day, and we've got four major chains. So I'm very happy with that. And so in addition to outreach to the uninsured, we, of course, will continue to work with the public sector groups. Yesterday I worked with one of the largest brokerage firms in Oregon, Willis, presenting the new contract to them and telling them the greater value that we'll have. And we will continue to discuss the program with other states, and we will continue the evidence-based messaging to add value to all our ex-purchasers in Oregon. So if there are any questions, I would be happy to take them.
Any questions?
Yes. Mr. Chair, I can appreciate the transparency piece of this, but is the plan to, when you're working with government groups, to send that information back to those groups, specifically when you're dealing with self-insured public groups?
Representative Greenlick and Representative Maurer, it is absolutely our intention to give them their own reports. It will be group-specific reports down to the NDC number. And so they could actually look at their executive summaries of monthly utilization and yearly utilization and say they've got 5,000 prescriptions of Lipitor. They can see that their rebate from Pfizer is on 5,000 prescriptions of Lipitor, and they can see the amount that the manufacturer is paying them, and they can see any deductions, and there will be none, and then they're going to get a check for that amount. As a matter of fact, it's even better than that, and I hate to go into so much detail, but in 3 months, one of the great things about the ODS contract is 3 months after you sign a contract with ODS, the group will start getting a guaranteed rebate amount, a per prescription amount. And so if they have, it's actually $2.60, and if they have 5,000 prescriptions in 1 month, they'll get 5,000 times $2.60 every month that they have that many prescriptions. And then when the manufacturer's checks start coming in about 12 months, if it's actually $1.60, they don't get asked to pay it back. If it's $3.60, they get the extra dollar per prescription. So it's and they at all along the way they can audit what they're getting to the experience that they've been paying for.
Follow up?
Yes.
Thank you.
Follow up.
So in there you said they if they and this is kind of a sidelight. If they don't, if they get a rebate of $2.60 and it's only $1.60, who pays? Where does that dollar? I mean, that almost sounds like
ODS has accepted that risk.
They've accepted it. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to thank you for the great work you're doing administering the program. This is really exciting and. It's helping people right now, which is wonderful, and having the ballot measure pass has helped a lot. I was just wondering if you can provide to legislators some breakdown by geography of folks participating in the program so, you know, we can get that information back to our districts. If, for example, we have folks in certain parts of the state who aren't taking up the program, we can somehow get that information out in town halls or whatever. So if you have any of that kind of geographic, you know, data, that'd be great.
Right. Chair Greenlick and Representative Kotek, we actually do have it on the old plan, the geomapping. We've geomapped our pharmacy network, which is how I know where the pharmacies are that we've gotten so far. We haven't geomapped the population yet because so many applications are coming in, but maybe... at the beginning of February, when I get our first enrollment report for ODS, I can provide a geo map for all of you.
That would be great.
Sure.
Thank you.
I've got a couple of questions. Missy, thank you very much for your presentation and for all your hard work getting this thing organized. The basic concept of the purchasing pool was that there would be possible discounts from the pharmacies because of being group purchasers to them, and we'll hear more from the Pharmacy Association in a bit. And that seemed to come very quickly. But the second part was that we would be able, by grouping purchasers together, to move market share and therefore get rebates from the manufacturers for that market share. Are the agreements for those rebates entirely going to be in the ODS company's hands? Is there going to be other way for us to make it worthwhile for the pharmacy, for the drug companies to provide rebates through the plan?
Chair Greenlick, initially we did not limit the, and I'm talking about the uninsured population, we didn't limit the uninsured formulary. It's an open formulary. They can use any drug that they want. We provide them with a tool that's Oregon Health Policy and Research developed with us based on our preferred drug list that shows dollar signs and happy faces for drugs under $10 and shows the more expensive with $4 or $5 signs. And we recommend they take that to their doctor and ask them, you know, is there a reason why I have to be on this drug with all these dollar signs? Now, we have a very high generic usage in that population, as I said, 81%. I think that if we got a big enough uninsured pool, we might be able to go to the pharmaceuticals and say, well, what if? Because we still have, the 19% of the pool that is using the brand drugs. So if we wanted to pare down the formulary and negotiate with them, that would be an option. I think that once we get a more credible sized network, we might want to consider doing that. When we launched the program, Bruce Goldberg, who you all know, he said, these are cash-paying customers. Why would you want to limit the formulary at this point? Let's launch. Let's see where we go from here. As far as the group side goes, yes, ODS will be doing that negotiation initially. However, in our contract, it says that we could have the option of getting involved, and we can have a group, say, the size of the one that we ran the numbers for, 165,000, if they came in, they would want to be directly involved themselves with negotiating with the pharmaceuticals. So we have that option in the future. At this point, I don't think we have the numbers to warrant it.
And my second question is, what's been the barrier to getting group enrollment from these groups? I mean, we heard of one group that really saved a great deal of money in a very short time.
And actually, that's the group that left because they actually had some big medical cases, and they were uninsured for their entire health package. And the big medical cases put them really at risk. And they, as soon as that happened, they said, we're out of here. We're going. And they went to a carrier and got fully insured. So even though they didn't get hurt on the prescription side, the medical side really affected it.
Thank you. Representative Flores?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Going back to page one of your presentation, the fourth slide, where you're talking about the influx, the growth of the program, you're anticipating 5,000 from the end of December to the end of this month. That's a huge workload. Who's doing that and undertaking that? Do you contract that out, and do you have any cost factor associated with that?
Chair Greenlick and Representative Flores, that's an excellent question. And we currently have 2.5 employees because...
Includes you.
Yeah, and that includes me. And we've all been on the phones, and we've all been opening envelopes and sending applications. But we couldn't keep up with it. Fortunately, the ODS companies came to our aid. And 2 weeks ago, I delivered 3,000 envelopes. In each of those envelopes is sometimes we get 10 applications because some businesses are having all of their employees sign applications because they're not offering any kind of RX coverage. So I know I delivered 3,000 envelopes. Since then, yesterday I delivered another 1,000 envelopes, and they're still coming in every day. The ODS companies didn't have to start enrolling until February, but they said, we can do this. We have a staff of many, and they're doing it. So they're going to have them. They're going to have them entered, opened, everything, and the ID cards ready to go. They'll be mailed on the 29th of this month.
A follow-up, please.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Thank you. And the reason that I'm just kind of giving a little inquiry about the costs associated with that is that this morning I heard in another committee where an outside vendor was data entering for the county clerks across the state at the rate of $175 an hour, mm-hmm. and we're anticipating 2,000 hours for a particular project, and that's a huge investment. So is that somewhat of the level that we're looking at here? Or?
Absolutely not. The charge that we're being charged $1 per claim for every uninsured claim that gets processed, and that dollar will be taken out of their savings. I anticipate right now the program is yielding $28 in savings. I think it's going to be more than that in the new contract, but it also will have that dollar cost taken out of it. It's never going to come to me. It'll be taken out at the point of service and sent back to ODS. Is that going to cover ODS cost? I don't think so. They started out asking us for twice that amount, and they came down to a dollar. And they're making a huge investment in this program. Just the setup and what they're doing for this uninsured population is setting them back. Not to mention the fact that they hired a new account executive to work with me to solicit group interest. He went down to Eugene with me yesterday. They're so serious about this, they're considering possibly hiring a consultant, a broker consultant to work on it. They believe in this program, as does WellPartner. WellPartner is their mail order. Both companies are Oregon companies, and they're excited as anything to be part of this Northwest initiative. And WellPartner is right there, too, doing anything that possibly. As a matter of fact, they ran a geo map for us when we got our last pharmacies entered. So I just have to say, ODS companies and WellPartner have stepped up to the plate, just like AARP did and Oregonians for Health Security with ballot measure 44. I mean, this program is just being carried around by people and Oregon business.
Mr. Chair, just one quick question we're missing. That is, why are we doing paper enrollment? I mean, do we have the option of doing Internet enrollment? That seems like it would save you a lot of envelopes.
Representative Greenlick and Representative Richardson, that's such a great question. And we actually looked into that, and it was so costly we couldn't afford it. We don't have a very big budget. As a matter of fact, my budget doesn't cover myself and my colleague Betty Wilton for the 2-year budget. We received a grant from the Department of Justice from a settlement they made, and that's been supplementing Betty's salary. So we don't have a lot of money. And we have to pay DOJ expenses, by the way, and all of this contracting and the interstate agreement cost a lot of money, paying them over $100 an hour, and I need them a lot. So when they told us the cost of building an online application system, it was more than we could afford.
Just a quick follow-up. The whole permitting process for contractors, and so many, many permits are now functioning online, and so we already have that being done in Oregon government, and it just seems like there ought to be a way to utilize what's already being done and then just make minor changes on the programming, but that would be a kind of a common sense approach. And
yeah, they'll still charge us to build it into our system. We did check into it. It's not to say that ODS might not do it for us on their website.
I bet they will.
Any other questions? Dr. Smith, would you like a final word?
Just Representative Greenlick and the committee, I'm just really glad that you invited us here so you could hear all the hard work that's been going on and getting those envelopes packed up and gone over to ODS as fast as we can. But we appreciate you listening.
Thank you very much.
Thanks.
Did you say what? You were back there. Thank you.
Good afternoon. For the record, I'm Reese Ehlers. I am the governor's health policy advisor. I'm probably new to quite a number of you. Aaron Kelly Seal and I have split the baby, so to speak, in terms of our portfolios, and I am assuming a lot of the healthcare responsibilities. I just wanted to come after Missy and Janine's presentation to tell you that we're very excited about this program, as you can imagine, and that the governor does have legislation this session to further expand the opportunity for other people in Oregon to come into the program, and that is currently public groups are allowed to come in, but not private groups, so we would move to extend the membership opportunities to private private groups, such as self-insured employers, et cetera. So I just wanted to let you know that's something that will be coming before you, and we hope you'll give it very favorable consideration, considering how really well this program is going. The second thing I'd like to say is that I think that the engineering and creativity that's gone into the negotiations and the leveraging opportunities with the state of Washington have really been maximized through Missy, the ODS companies, and the team we had from Washington. And I think that's a great service to the public in terms of stretching and making, getting the deepest and best discounts that we have. This further, as you've heard, supports evidence-based medicine and also transparency, which is a goal that all of us have. And then finally, I'd like to give a plug for, in the governor's recommended budget, there is funding for Missy and her staff, and we'd like to bring that half position up to a full-time position. And so I hope you will consider that, too. It's a quite a modest crew that is doing this. I spent a couple of months in Uber before I came to the governor's office. They're beginning to look like a freight operation at this point with the envelope moving in and out, and I think that the return on your investment is huge for the people of Oregon. So I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to just say these few words.
You're obviously in the wrong room for that discussion. You need to find your way to Ways and Means.
I understand, but for those of you who either sit on Ways and Means or have colleagues who sit on Ways and Means,
duly noted, Ruth.
Thank you very much.
Any questions?
Thank you again.
Thank you very much. Our friend and colleague, former Representative Thompson, can you join us, please?
My pleasure. Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jim Thompson. I'm currently Executive Director of the Oregon State Pharmacy Association, and I should say in that position, I have my own difficulties because I represent all flavors of pharmacy, some of which are applauding this particular program and some of which are not. So we have to be a little careful how I phrase things. In general, I think the acceptance has been very good. I believe that we'll find all of the pharmacies.
Excuse me a moment.
Or BlackBerry.
If there are cell phones turned on in the room, it would be helpful if they were turned off. When they fire, they interfere with the, even if it's quiet.
Even if it's on silence, yeah. It needs to be off. Thanks.
Which I'll model right now.
As I was saying, I believe that we're going to see all of the chain pharmacies essentially sign up for this program. And a lot of the independent pharmacies, particularly in the urban areas, are signing up for it. I can't say if there's anybody who's just terribly excited about it because pharmacy is getting hit with a lot of new and different things, a lot of pressures nationally as well as locally, and it's a time of great change. So one more difficulty is not something people are looking forward to. I'd like to zero in, though, on one area that I think we're going to have a major problem, and that is the small independent pharmacies in the rural areas. When you deal with averages like we do with the average manufacturing price or the average wholesale price, those are averages computed across great numbers of transactions. And, of course, when you deal with averages, there are outliers. And in our particular system, the outliers are small, lower volume, independently owned, oftentimes family-owned businesses in rural areas. They simply are not competitive with chain pharmacies or larger volume operations. In many cases here in Oregon, there is only one pharmacy in an entire county. So it's not so much talking about huge numbers of people, it's great distances. So that the lower population levels in those zones have to go a long ways for alternative service. So we're setting up a system whereby large parts of the state could potentially be underserved. And that's the population I'm getting most of the pushback from. I shared with you some of that testimony that was given to me the last few days, and you can share it with the committee if you want. But anyway, I'm not sure what the answer is to that, because it costs more to provide health care in rural communities. It costs more because supplies cost more in lower volumes. It costs more because the volumes are going through the system are lower. And at the same time, we're dealing with communities that have a disproportionately large number of lower-income people that need and can use this program. I talked to a number of pharmacists yesterday in rural eastern Oregon counties who are not signing up for the program. They just simply can't afford to do it. It doesn't work out in their scheme of things, and that's too bad. Some of them might change their minds as it goes on. I don't know what's going to happen there. On the flip side, we have built into the system the alternative of using mail-order pharmacy, and so I have to be a little careful, because it's not a good time for me to be bashing mail-order pharmacy, because, well, partner pharmacists are members of our organization. So one wins if another loses. I would remind you, though, that mail-order pharmacy is a time-consumptive strategy. It doesn't do a whole lot of good when at 6 o'clock in the evening your child has an earache, and it's a bad time to be using mail order pharmacy. And if this moves as it could, we will see pharmacies in some of the rural areas close. That is, if large numbers of people in those communities sign up for mail order and shift the business away from the only existing retail pharmacy, then that will be a problem. I don't have any solutions today. It's well above my pay grade, but I'm sure most of you know exactly what to do. Healthcare reform is one big easy topic, as you all know. So, with that, I think I would side with Missy that her program is underfunded. She needs more help. And the success of the program for the more urban parts of the state is going to be based on access and being able to efficiently handle the people that are coming into the program. And if we're going to do this as a state, then we need to properly fund the application and her office in making it happen. With that, do you have any questions?
Thank you. Other questions?
I gave you a handout, by the way. Let me explain that in just a minute. That just came out from the Federal Budget Office, which is the best explanation I've seen ever on the convolutions of drug pricing. In every healthcare committee group I've ever been associated with, the evils of prescription drug cash flow always come up, and somebody gets beat up as being the guilty party. This lays out pretty carefully where the money trail is, how these things are calculated, and how convoluted it is. And I think I'd remind you that the major portion is that a major misunderstanding usually happens. Pharmacies do not buy their products from drug companies. They buy their products from wholesalers and intermediaries, so there are all kinds of middlemen involved. And it costs money to supply through middlemen, but that's just the way the system is. So, you know, there's a tendency, I think, to bash pharmacies and pharmaceutical companies in the same sentence, and they're completely opposite ends of the spectrum. They have nothing to do with one another. So, with that, any questions?
Representative Cannon.
Thank you, Chair. I'm going to make at least one assumption in this question, and because I'm new to this, please correct me if my assumption is incorrect.
We're all new to this.
But what I understand about the program suggests that many of the people using it are people who were not accessing the drugs they needed until the program became available. If that's the case, then it's hard to see, even if the majority of those users in these rural areas are relying on mail order rather than their local pharmacy, it's hard to see how it would hurt the local pharmacy if they weren't customers of the local pharmacy prior to the enactment of the program.
I think it helps the local pharmacy in the area of generics, because they do get a higher margin, and even though they've given up a lot of that margin and discounts back to the program, there's still a relatively healthy margin involved. But in a number of the brand name products, it's been pointed out to me that the reimbursement is actually below their acquisition cost, so it costs them money to deliver a prescription of certain things. And again, I don't think we have enough data yet to know what the actual washout will be, but the concerns are there, and if the pharmacies don't sign up for the program, then the program isn't offered in those kinds of areas. So we won't know how it works out in the long run.
In the original testimony, there was a lot of testimony about two things, people not being able to afford the drugs, mm-hmm. and on the other hand, people paying more for drugs than any other customer if they didn't have insurance, and there was a big piece of that being the inequity of individuals not being able to get anything like the same prices. You want to follow up on that?
Oh, no, thank you. I was just nodding.
Yeah. The Federal Trade Commission estimates that the cash-paying customer, which any pharmacist in the nation wouldn't be telling the truth if they said they didn't want to see one come through their door, pays on average 15% more for their drugs than insured customers. And now, again, those are averages. But cash-paying customers are worth money to pharmacies. And with the Oregon Prescription Drug Plan, of course, we face a situation where there won't be any cash-paying customers. I mean, you'd have to be out of your mind to be a cash-paying pharmacy customer under this plan, because if you save anything, it's money directly in your pocket if you have no insurance.
Senator Mar?
Mr. Chair, thank you. When you talk about rural, what do you mean? I mean, because rural is defined in many different ways, and rural in Southern Oregon is not necessarily rural by Oregon.
Right.
So what when you say rural.
The most extensive rural are the parts of Oregon that have one pharmacy per county or very large area. And if that pharmacy doesn't participate, it's a large area, though it be relatively small population, that isn't served other than mail order. An example I could give you would be Heppner and Condon. There's one pharmacy in each of those communities, and that's the only pharmacies in that whole big area out there. They're both owned by the same couple, a husband-wife pharmacy team. And my understanding is, after speaking with them several days ago, they are not going to participate in the program, which means the next closest pharmacy, I believe, would be Hermiston.
John Day.
Maybe John Day. I don't think John Day is. There's only one pharmacy left in John Day, and I don't believe they're participating. So, you know, if I was Senator Farioli, I'd be very concerned about this in terms of access, but because that's his part of the world. In your part of the country, it might not be quite so serious because you have some larger cities with chain pharmacies, and chain pharmacies sign up for the program at a corporate level. So all of the pharmacies, no matter what, would be a part of it. I think there's some discussion among independent pharmacies in your particular area about the impact of this, and some of the people are not real happy with the possibilities of the effect on their practice. But, again, we don't have enough data. We have to see this thing run. And, you know, I could sit here and say, well, because of this, we're going to see a bunch of pharmacies go out of business. Well, that's always the doomsday situation, and we, in fact, can't document that. We won't know that until they do go out of business, and if that happens. So that we don't have any track to run on for this. The only thing that I can tell you is independent pharmacies in rural areas run on narrower margins than higher volume pharmacies in more urban areas. And that depends on local competition. A small town that has two pharmacies doesn't necessarily mean it's twice as well off. Neither one of them may be doing very well. But a larger town with five pharmacies, they could all be just going like gangbusters. So it depends entirely on the situation and the business model that we're dealing with. We used to have a business model where a lot of the small pharmacies were prescription pharmacies only. They didn't sell greeting cards and books and fashion wear and all that stuff. Well, that's kind of gone by the wayside, but we do still have a lot of rural pharmacies that are largely healthcare as opposed to more of a department store type merchandising. So all pharmacies are not created equal. They never were. They aren't now. You know, and that's where the impact comes.
I visited with the matriarch of that family in Heppner when the Rules and Elections Committee last year visited Heppner, and I worry about that area with or without this problem. And I think somewhere along the line we're going to try and get a rural health piece on the agenda here to talk about the issues of rural health. We're going to try to get the representatives from the rural areas together to help us, but I mean, here's an area that will be a huge area if that woman who is at least my age, struggling to keep two or maybe three pharmacies going without the ability to get pharmacists to come out there.
Yeah.
I mean, and that really certainly is a house of cards that could easily collapse, and that will leave people 50 or 100 miles from the nearest pharmacy. It's a huge
problem. It's a corner of our rural health initiative we really need to look at, because we can prop up physicians and hospitals and all kinds of things. We lose the pharmacy underpinnings, and we're right back to a long drive or a wait for mail order to get the services. And there are four pharmacies I'm aware of right now in Oregon, all rural, independently owned pharmacies that have been for sale for some time, and there are no takers. They're falling off communities, a change aren't interested in going there, and there just aren't people who want to take a risk on buying a rural pharmacy in a relatively isolated small town at this time, because of the changes in the pharmacy profession and the business base of pharmacy. But, so you're right. It's something we need to deal with in terms of the whole healthcare picture.
Madam Vice Chair?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I couldn't agree more. I think we have to build up our rural health infrastructure. I'd be curious to know, and maybe some of the other panelists can bring us additional information. They are doing some really good things in Washington State, and if we're working with them in consortium, what are they doing around their rural health infrastructure on this issue? It would be good to know. But my specific question was, can you provide – I conceptually get what the problem is, but maybe some modeling, you know, a generic drug and a – brand name drug, and what, you know, in different size pharmacies, and what that looks like in the margins, and just actual numbers. That would help me understand the flow of dollars a little easier.
It depends a little bit on purchasing, because the larger the benefit to the pharmacy is in purchasing of generics, because they have control on which generic of a class of trade or which generics they're stocking. So they get extended better discounts for stocking certain products and better rewards for limiting competition from the generic manufacturers, and that can be considerable. It's less than what large urban pharmacies get because of volume, but it could be 50% or better difference in price, sometimes even more than that. And pharmacists generally pass that on mostly because I don't think you get away with doing anything else. You know, we generally know what pricing is, and generics are cheaper to buy than others. The problem comes probably more with the name brand, because pharmacies have no latitude to negotiate for those prices. They're sold to wholesalers and through wholesalers, and pharmacies don't decide which name brand drugs they're going to stock. They stock pretty much all of them because they're individual products in a class, and they have to. So the discounts go to PBMs for putting certain drugs on their formulary as opposed to others, and they go to the wholesalers for pushing certain drugs over others. And the pharmacies pay a much higher price, lower margin for those products. So, and in terms of how much of a difference, if you look at something like amoxicillin, an old-time antibiotic, been around a long time, it's available in 20 or 30 different generic forms. It's almost an over-the-counter type pricing where it's very, very inexpensive. And it sells inexpensively but at very high profit for a pharmacy. Where something else in the $200 prescription range and a name brand, a pharmacy, may make $2-3 on. They don't make it there. And but there's nothing they can do about it. I mean, one that's been pointed out to me repeatedly is Plavix, which you see advertised a lot on TV, that a lot of pharmacies, particularly independent pharmacies, because of their volumes, lose money on every prescription of that they sell because of the way in which Medicare, Medicaid, and insurance reimbursements work. They don't catch up with price increases in time, and there's no incentive to do that. And the pharmacy takes it in the shorts, so it's a balancing act. But it's a tough business.
Please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this might be totally left out of left field, but I know they're independent pharmacies, but are there any models out there in other states where the independent pharmacies form their own consortium to help buy at greater volume? I mean,
no, actually, a lot of states have laws against that. If they're not part of a of some kind of shell corporation thing, because it comes under the price-fixing laws. So if they get involved in, as independent entities sitting down around the table, you know, trying to group buy, it's deemed illegal. And I'm not sure where we are in Oregon. I don't believe it happens, so it may be then it's an entanglement here as well. But you have other groups then that do work through an umbrella organization, United Drug, and some of those, and they do, although they're independently or partially independently owned, they buy from their own warehouse, essentially. So this is the other thing with the drug wholesalers, too. There are five major drug wholesalers in the United States that are very large. But then, like Safeway and Walmart, Walgreens, all of them have their own warehouses. They are, in fact, their own drug wholesalers for most of their products. And the products that it doesn't pay them to be their own drug wholesaler, they buy from one of the big five. So they're dealing in a little different pool than an independent pharmacist who is buying everything usually from one wholesaler or maybe two. And they get any discounts they get are based on their overall business volume. And if it's small, you know, like any other small businessman, they get it in the shorts. You know, no good deals for being small in this world. And it's very typical of pharmacy as well.
Thank you.
Cosmetics, that's where you make the money. You can figure out a way to have a rural cosmetic store.
I remember school supply day.
Yeah.
My days in pharmacy. There is an issue, though. There's a question of the dispensing fee and the cost of the drug.
Yes, yes.
And sometimes that's where the issue is.
Let's talk about that just a minute, since you brought it up. And that's changing rapidly as well. According to NCPA, National Community Pharmacy Association, and several other big national organizations, and that's based on about four studies I'm aware of, the cost of dispensing runs between $10 and $13.50 per prescription. Now, the dispensing cost is all of the overhead, the pharmacist's time, labor, lights, store fixtures, all those things we call overhead. And that is a cost that, you know, I have questions about because nobody gets it anymore. I think we, you know, most of the reimbursement plans are way less than that. But yet pharmacies have not in mass closed their doors, so they're making it up somewhere else. And they're making it up on narrower margins. They're making it up with efficiencies. They're making it up with service reductions, all kinds of things. But the business goes on. I don't see a time. I think Louisiana passed a law in the last couple of years allowing $10 and $15 dispensing fees for their Medicaid program. I would love to propose that law in Oregon if I thought I had a chance of getting it passed, because I'd probably get a raise out of that one. But you know, no, it isn't going to happen, because the whole field is changing so rapidly because of the way reimbursements work through Medicare, Medicaid, big insurance companies and whatnot. These are all negotiated situations and contracts, and everybody's getting less than they used to. So the dispensing fee, where at one time dispensing fees were the way you paid for things, a pharmacist made a very little margin on product, and you know, because their costs were covered with a dispensing fee, they were just a X number of dollars add-on. Well, that's not there anymore. So, and then of course you've got all these rebate things that come through, not to pharmacists, but they affect what wholesalers will do and whatnot. So it's a very difficult and convoluted money trail to figure out how pharmacies make money anymore, and most of them make up the difference with other product lines that they have as well. It'd be extremely difficult today to run a pharmacy just selling prescription drugs like the little pillbox type places used to be.
Jim, thank you very much. Do you want to know? Oh, I'm sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just quickly, I mean, I think your point about Medicaid reimbursements is really important because, you know, we know that in rural communities, a lot of the folks are, you know, a higher proportion of individuals living in rural communities are on the Oregon Health Plan.
Right.
I mean, we know that nationally, rural communities are very impacted by Medicaid policy, period. So it's something we should keep in mind as we look at any changes we might make to the health plan and how we support rural health.
I think if I'd ask you one thing today, it would be, when you're looking at this whole situation, include pharmacies in the Rural Health Initiative. So, and I don't know how you do a differential or how you calculate something like that, but we're going to have to maintain pharmacies in the rural area if we're going to maintain thorough health care delivery there. And it has to pencil out. People aren't going to run these businesses if they can't make any money doing it. So it's not a competition matter, it's a survival matter. Mm-hmm.
It isn't only money, it's also manpower.
Oh, manpower is huge, yeah.
Very hard to get.
Yeah, and the thing that impacts, again, in these local small rural areas, oftentimes the pharmacist is the owner. But if a pharmacist is trying to, say, open extended hours, they're not going to work 80 hours a week on their own. So now they're hiring in a relief pharmacist who's making $100,000 a year. And that gets really expensive in a hurry. So you cut back on the hours is what happens. And cut back on the availability. But, and we have a shortage of pharmacists. So.
Thank you very much.
If you have other questions, then call me anytime.
Thank you. I do want to note for the record that the Oregon State Pharmacy Association was very helpful in the original formulation of SB 875.
We try not to be the bad guys all the time.
We thought it would be useful while we're talking about the bulk purchasing to have a little related discussion on how Medicare Part D worked for our dual eligibles. It was something we were very worried about in the last session, and I think it would be very important for us to have a bit of an update. So, Kitchen?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Dr. Kitchen, Tina Kitchen, the medical director for seniors and people with disabilities of the Department of Human Services. And I also thank you for this invitation to come talk to you folks. This can be as detailed or as brief as you wish. I briefly would like to touch on three major topics, one of which is how did the open enrollment period just go for Oregonians, second of which is a bit of DHS money piece. And
can you excuse me just a moment?
Sure.
We're only open for invited testimony today, but I think we'll have a few minutes, and I'd be happy if you want to testify to invite you to testify. Can I do that?
Sure.
You sure?
Well,
you must have okay. Yeah, well, all right. So if there are folks here that would like me to invite them to testify, please let us know. Sorry, go ahead.
Okay, I'm sorry. And the third one is how the MMA has impacted our state-run institutional pharmacies. As everybody knows, Medicare Modernization Act, MMA, affectionately known, started in January of 06. It created a Medicare drug benefit for Medicare beneficiaries and transferred about 54,000 people who were both Medicare and Medicaid eligibles their drug responsibility to Medicare, which was a fairly big transition for everybody. We have been reporting regularly back on that process through the emergency board with the last report back in November, but we just finished the first open enrollment, well, the second open enrollment period, I guess is what I would call it, in January 1 for Oregonians. And there was a great deal of flux here in the state. This looks like it's a program under change. And 2006, we had about 75 drug plans available to Oregonians in different parts of the state. That included both plans that only offered the drug benefit and those that offered the full Medicare managed care benefit plus the drugs. In 07, we are now seeing about 170 plans. Yeah, it was a big increase, with 75 standalone prescription drug plans. We also saw one more of our Medicaid managed care plans become available for Medicare benefits. They became a Medicare Advantage plan, which means that now there's only two Medicaid managed care plans that don't offer both Medicaid and Medicare services to dual eligibles. For low-income seniors and people with disabilities, the people who do actually qualify for Medicare, we lost four plans that had no premiums for that low income, which meant that everybody in those plans either had to choose to stay in those plans and begin paying something out of pocket for their premium, or they had to switch plans. We also had four new plans that became zero premium. That ended up with about 10,000 low-income Oregonians needing assistance in choosing a plan in this last 3 months. I think sort of the basic line here is that there's really some ongoing work impact to those local seniors and people with disabilities, local offices, and the area agencies on aging. And this is not likely to disappear anytime soon. These are tough choices if you haven't had to assist somebody with choosing a plan. These are very tough choices, especially when you've got 170 choices to sort through at that point for the average Oregonian. Money-wise, from DHS, clawback was a favorite topic last time. The original federal legislation was designed so that the states would continue to pay a decreasing percentage every year of the anticipated drug costs for the dual eligibles. Unfortunately, it appears that the bill is going to actually increase this year instead of decline, because there's also a national drug inflation factor built into that. So although by report from the federal government, it appears that the drug costs are actually declining, the state share will increase in the next year. We haven't yet gotten January's bill, but it's supposed to go from $91.66 per capita to $96.13 per capita. So that could be a budget impact. The other piece of it is that with all of the difficult transition time when this first got started, DHS had to continue to provide services to some of those duals that were falling in the cracks of the computer systems of the federal government and talking. We were promised reimbursement. We have continued to be promised reimbursement, but we have yet to see most of that money at least. Lastly, just to go ahead and talk about the state-run pharmacy at the state institutions. So I'm mainly talking about Oregon State Hospital and Eastern Oregon Training Center. This has been a revolution for them. They have gone from being a pharmacy that concentrates only on getting the appropriate doctor's orders, dispensing the medications, and making sure they get to the right person, to having to almost become a retail pharmacy and bill at point of sale, track individuals' medication costs per individual, account for that, get back payments from all of these different plans, and assign the revenue to an individual patient. So it's been a really big change for them, in addition to the fact that they've had to have social workers assist people in those institutions to choose a plan. It's been a complicated process. At this point, we are renegotiating contracts with the new plans that are coming in, which has also been a bit of a difficulty because it really is aimed, contracts are aimed at retail pharmacies, and they don't understand that the state of Oregon is not willing to obey the rules of Arizona or other things that are in their standard contracts. We've currently billed over $400,000 for these Medicare drugs and have been reimbursed about $380,000 of those. We're working on getting caught up with some of that, and again, that ends up being a significant workload issue because you have to have pharmacies that now not only just dispense the medications, but at least pharmacy techs do the bill of sale by entering all that into a new computer system that mimics the retail pharmacy system. You have to have administrative staff track all of those payments that come in from numerous different plans and then assign them to the individual patient accounts. That was my brief presentation. If people want further details, I'd be more than happy to provide them.
Maybe we can stimulate some of that. Representative Gelson?
Thank you. Thank you, Dr. Kitchen, for your testimony. Eastern Oregon Training Center, if I understand it, is a very small institution for adults with developmental disabilities with less than 50 people who were there. much smaller than the state hospital.
Chair Greenlake, Representative Gelford, yes, it is. There are actually less than 40, if I do understand now. They share a pharmacy with what may be called Eastern Oregon Psychiatric Center or Blue Mountain Treatment Center, depending upon the old or the new terminology.
Do you have a sense of how many individual plans that pharmacy has had to accommodate for in relation to the small population that's served there?
Chair Greenlake, Representative Gelser, actually, I don't have a good count of that. I think there was 5 or 6 plans, but that is out of distant memory.
Have they had to increase the number of staff that are there? Do you have an idea of the increase in the number of staff to administer that?
Chair Greenlake, Representative Gelser, I know that Oregon State Hospital has had to increase the staff to do the entry. I also know that the Eastern Oregon Psych Center Pharmacy, which is what it's officially still called, I don't believe has increased staff, but they're also very much struggling to do this extra workload.
Okay, thank you. And can I have another follow-up on it? It's a new question.
Well, a few more.
Yeah. A few more questions, thank you. In terms of the implementation of this act, I had a town hall meeting last spring and have had several contacts from constituents that were dual eligibles, and part of their concern was access to medications that they had become accustomed to and needed to for their ongoing care, and this was in particular individuals with mental illness. What has been your observation of individuals' access to the medications that they actually need specifically for mental illness and seizure disorders?
Chair Greenlake, Representative Gelser, the federal government now has total control over this program. They have created certain classes of drugs that they have said that these plans need to offer substantially all. That gets interpreted by different plans differently, and I do believe that some of these prescription drug plans, PDPs, have a better formulary than others. I think it's very individualized.
So follow-up? If I have constituents...
I gave you a blank check.
What?
You gave me a blank check.
I'm not used to those.
I'll stop you when the account runs short.
Thank you, Representative Greenwood. So if an individual is having difficulty getting the medications that they need, it could be an issue of needing to change plan. Are there individuals that are counseling some of these specialized populations to help them find the unique plans that they might need to meet those individualized needs?
Chair Greenlake, Representative Gelser, there is some staff available through Seniors and People with Disabilities to assist, especially dual eligibles with very tough situations. For dual eligibles, they are actually allowed to change plans. For the average Oregonian who is a Medicare beneficiary, you're locked in for a year. And the only recourse that you really have is going through an appeals process through the plan and then eventually outside of the plan.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions? Yes,
Mr. Chair, the question I have has to do with formularies and changing formularies. Once you pick a plan, you do pick a plan based on a formulary in some cases. And my understanding was a concern last year through this iteration that the formula, the companies could change the formulary midstream. And was that, in fact, the case last year?
Chair Greenlake, Representative Maurer, they are allowed to, the drug plans are allowed to change formulary with a certain amount of notice to the people who are getting those current drugs. I do not have enough knowledge to know how often that happened. I do not have any specific knowledge of a great deal of concern that this has caused Medicare beneficiaries a great deal of problems, but I just haven't heard that. I don't not know.
Okay.
Chair Greenlake, can I just ask a question?
Representative Bonamici.
Thank you. Thank you so much for your testimony. My experience with Medicare Part D has been extremely limited and very frustrating. But I want to step back and ask a kind of a big picture question. Can you please talk about what efforts, if any, are being made at the federal level to improve this system, which seems to be fraught with many problems?
Chair Greenlake, Representative Bonamici, I'm not so sure I'm the person to talk about that because that really is a U.S. congressional effort. I have heard from the news, just like probably most people sitting here, that there has been some move to at least require or to change the law to allow the federal government to negotiate with the drug companies over the prices. I've also heard that the president is not wanting to sign that bill if it would ever pass, but it's all congressional.
Thank you.
I have a question. My understanding was if our dual eligibles didn't sign up for a plan, they would be assigned to a plan originally, and I assume this year, if they don't change, they would remain in the plan they're in. If they're in a plan, first of all, how did that go in the first instance? And second, if they remained in a plan, didn't change, and the premiums began to roll, and they didn't have money to pay for the premiums, what's going to happen in that situation?
Chair Greenlake, the first few months of 06 are a bad memory because this is a massive program to bring up all at once all across the United States, and it requires numerous computer systems to talk to each other. They're still having troubles with computer systems accurately talking to each other. So you have a lot of people that in that beginning fell through the cracks. And we would have numerous times that people had chosen a plan, but the computer did not know that they were in a plan, and then they would get notices that they were in a different plan. It created a great deal of confusion, hence why Medicaid had to step up and continue to pay drug costs for people who the computer system was saying, sorry, you don't exist. That has gotten somewhat better, but that is still an ongoing problem. With this new time, with some plans dropping out and some plans continuing, if you chose a plan rather than was auto-assigned to a plan, if you chose a plan that quit being a zero premium plan, you are in that same plan. So all of a sudden, if you didn't pay attention, you may now have a premium, and I think it's even up to $48 in some situations, that you may be being billed. So you had to actively change your plan if you had chosen the plan in the beginning. If you had been auto-assigned that plan, then the computer took you back out of that old plan and put you in a new one with that was zero premium.
And the premium wasn't paid?
This is a Medicare benefit, not a Medicaid benefit, and they can be denied services. That's part of that 10,000 people that we've been working with to try to get them into plans that work for them. We do believe that there's a remaining 5,000 out there that may be getting premiums right now that should not be being charged premiums.
Thank you. Any more questions? Well, we really appreciate this. This is such a complicated issue, and it's great to have folks in your department, Dr. Kitchen, who can explain the morass about it.
Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Do you have any indication that somebody would like to be invited? Not? Well, expeditiously. Hold the phone. Oh, I definitely do. I want to remind two things. You will be hearing sometime in the near future House Bill 2216, the bill that the sailors referred to before, the governor's bill to expand the pool further. And I do want to remind you that we'll be meeting jointly with the Senate Health Policy and Public Affairs Committee Monday and Wednesday at 10 a.m. And we'll be meeting back on Friday at 3 p.m. Some of that committee, but not all, will be joining us at that. And we expect, if things go as expected, to move Healthy Kids on Friday afternoon. So our intention is to spend a lot of time on that, hear what we can hear about it, and to be prepared to move it, not for action, but onto the Revenue Committee. So there'll be, and after that, onto the Ways and Means Committee. So there's going to be lots of time to have input into that bill. What's the plan for the subcommittees next week?
On Tuesday, the subcommittee on policy will be hearing two bills, one on the immunization registry and one on
something else.
I'm totally drawing a blank. We'll be hearing
Sandy's for it.
Thank you, Sandy. Chiropractor. So House Bill 2188 on changes to the immunization registries and 2242, which scope of practice and various things around chiropractic care.
And Thursday's agenda is yet to be determined.
And the Access Committee is
not
going to meet, although...
Because of the joint.
Because of the joint, although, again, we were... The Access Subcommittee was invited to meet with the Senate's Special Committee on Healthcare Access, whatever it is, the Bates-Westland Committee. And we are invited to do so again. They were trying to get multiple meetings, but we haven't heard anything about that yet. So
rumor has it that they are looking at yet another day to meet, but we have not heard anything official, and they are still working on an agenda for Wednesday. So stay tuned. I'll email to the Access Subcommittee any of that information.
The governor is scheduled to testify in one of those meetings. Do we know which one it is?
Monday morning.
The Monday morning meeting.
Yes. And that Access Subcommittee invitation is to the joint or to the Senate Commission meeting on Wednesday afternoon at 4:45.
Correct.
The Senate Committee.
The Senate Special Committee on Health Care Reform.
On Health Care Reform. The intention is that we're set up as the Access Subcommittee, besides doing our work, which we'll get to, which we're sharing with the full committee, getting to our work, and also to serve as a joint committee with them when invited or when needed. Anybody in the committee? Anything further? We're adjourned.